Welcome to Common Ground YYC on Livewire Calgary.
Reviendra à la ville de Calgary. Calgary! Here come the
flames! Champions! Today, Calgary is a different place than it was yesterday.
Welcome to episode 3. I'm your host, Josh White. Today's guest is Elsbeth Maher. Elsbeth is Vice President, People and Engagement at YWCA Calgary. Prior to joining the YW, Elsbeth was the Director of Research, Workforce and Strategy at Calgary Economic Development. Elsbeth also previously worked as an Engagement Manager for Critical Mass at Calgary, and Elsbeth currently sits on the Board of Directors for Calgary Sexual Health Centre. I have to say, my conversation with Elsbeth is really the reason why I do this podcast. We had a really interesting conversation. It was, I thought, really valuable. We dove right into the topic of Me Too, and Elsbeth has some really interesting perspectives on that movement that you won't want to miss. We talked about the work YWCA does in our community. We touched on the challenges women continue to face in our city. We talked about women in leadership roles and its importance, and a whole bunch of other things that you'll want to stay tuned for. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I know I did. And now I bring you Elsbeth Maher.
Elsbeth Maher from the YWCA. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Happy Gender Equality Week.
Yes, happy Gender Equality Week. Well, I wasn't sure if we should keep recording this since there's nothing going on in the world. There's not a lot to talk about, but we'll try and figure it out.
Yeah, it's been kind of dull on all things women and gender. So, I'm sure we'll make something up.
Yeah, we'll make something up. But how about that? Like, how about the moment we're in right now with Me Too and everything that's going on at the Supreme Court, women's issues generally? From your point of view, what do you make of the moment we're in right now?
Well, I think for lots of women, Thursday and Friday and the weeks leading up to it with the Kavanaugh hearings have been just incredibly triggering, incredibly painful for women who are survivors of sexual abuse and sexual misconduct, seeing it play out like that and seeing on this incredibly high profile stage, Dr. Ford being so poised, living out her worst nightmares and describing experiences that are so familiar for so many women, that's, it's hugely upsetting. And lots of women are mad. And then you see the candidate who, let's not forget, he's applying for a job. Mm-hmm. And he's, he shows up as this unhinged character. And yet there's a whole bunch of people backing him up. I think, that just gets really demoralizing. And you see it play out even on the editorial pages of the Calgary Herald. And I think lots of us are just looking around as progressive women, giving our heads a shake, saying, where are we? How are we still having these conversations in this polarized way?
Yeah, on the other hand, as some of these painful exercises are being played out in a very public eye, we're also going through Me Too. Do you see that as, by and large, a really healthy moment in our history and sort of airing out the experiences that women have gone through over the past generations?
I absolutely do. I think, Me Too has given space for women and for men to talk about something that for so long has gone unspoken. And it's that safety in numbers. I think two things that I observe about Me Too would be that it's created a really, really broad dialogue because it's Me Too for everything from, harassment in the workplace and comments that are unsettling to folks, all the way to really violent and abusive and pervasive acts that have happened to folks. So that's one thing I think is the sort of continuum of the conversation within Me Too and what are we Me Tooing about. But also, I think what it's done is, when I speak about Me Too with men I know, they're open eyes and saying, oh my God, I had no idea it was this bad.
Yeah.
I had no idea it was every woman I know who's experienced this. And I think, you know, if we're able now to have that honest conversation, that's a really positive thing, because it has been every woman I know.
Yeah.
And so it's something we have talked about at, you know, our chick dinners. It's not necessarily something we've talked about at couples nights.
Yeah. And it's, I'm assuming, you know, quite painful, but also quite healthy in the long run that this moment happens, that this is able to come out into the public. Are you seeing any changes as a result of what's been happening in the last 12, 18 months with Me Too?
I think changes because we're normalizing so much of the recognition and the naming of these behaviors. I think we're taking a really critical and retrospective look at things that might have seemed like part of pop culture. Mm-hmm. You know, I read a couple of really good pieces about movies that were popular in the 80s. And when you look at them now, or when I watch them now with my teenage daughter and think, oh, yeah, that was not okay then. But we didn't have the language for it, and we didn't have the cultural frame that we do now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is a super positive change. And it also means that we can start to really have those meaty conversations about how do we, you know, as men, women, gender diverse people, how do we treat one another irrespective of gender roles?
Elsbeth, you and I were chatting, you know, a little bit before and during the recording of this podcast about, you know, the challenges of talking about, you know, nuance.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the trickier conversations related to Me Too.
Yeah. I think that there's a side of Me Too that we haven't necessarily solved yet, which is for men who have maybe made an off-color joke or smacked a woman on the ass, those are things that 5, 10, 15 years ago, we didn't have language around. And we didn't have the same kind of standard. The bar has definitely moved. And so I think there are men who are hearing some of these conversations, and maybe if they're reflective on them, thinking, holy shit, I think I'm someone's Me Too. And the part that I don't think we collectively have unpacked yet is, what are they supposed to do about that?
Yeah.
If they feel terrible about it, and they feel like they want to open up the conversation to say, hey, you know what, I was remembering at that Christmas party where I think I said something to you that might have offended you. I don't know what the space for forgiveness looks like.
Yeah.
And if we're able to be nuanced enough to recognize that violence and sexual harassment happens on a very broad continuum, for folks who are feeling badly about the slights on that continuum, what can they do to say, you know what, I think I know better now, and I think I want to do better now. And I don't know that we have good answers for that yet. And that's certainly not everybody. That's not the Gian Gomeshis and the Judge Kavanaughs. But I think there's this sort of reflective, progressive dude who might be thinking about what could he do differently.
Yeah. And in addition to that, just from, you know, the male perspective and reflecting and thinking about Me Too, you were chatting a little bit about, you know, this idea of, you know, women making gains here is not a zero sum. It's mm-hmm. not about making men's life miserable or worse. It's about making women's lives better.
Well, I think, you know, where this whole conversation gets really dangerous is if we start to say, oh, in order for women and diverse people to do better, men have to do worse. Like, let's not accept that. Let's also recognize that there are things about these super defined gender roles or you know, the old school thinking around who gets to do what that are also limiting for men. And that's not okay either, right? I think of men I know who have chosen the right thing for their family was for them to be the dads who are picking up kids at school.
Mm-hmm.
And let's not give them the hero cookie for doing that. Let's recognize that that's part of truly equitable partnership.
Yeah.
And that the permission to do that, the permission to be nurturing, to take paternity leave, to be a partner in a different way is part of the win for men. And if we had a different score sheet, if we had a score sheet that wasn't about who got elected and who earned how much money and who had, you know, which car at the end of the race, I think we would start to score differently for who got to be present at someone else's success. And that can be valued.
So just to step back a little bit, let's talk a little bit about yourself, where you arrived, where you are. You're with the YWCA. How did you get there? And maybe tell us a little bit about the work
Sure.
that you do with the YWCA here in Calgary.
Yeah. So YW is Calgary's largest and longest serving women's organization. We were founded in 1907, so more than 100 years old. And at that time, the organization used to meet women at the train station when they were coming in to find their way in Calgary. And in lots of ways, that's still very much what we do. We provide shelter and housing and employment skills, counseling, childcare to women and their families, and try to support them to make their way in the community. But another really important part of what this organization does is that we have a commitment not only to do service work, but also to do some advocacy work and join and start important conversations about how women are recognized and engaged in our community.
So one of the programs you run is Walk a Mile in Your Shoes. So how do you think that program has worked in terms of, it seems, I understand the purpose to be to really have men and everyone in our society really be able to understand and empathize. It's a sort of a literal walk in a woman's shoes is the event,
yeah.
But it's more of a figurative, you know, step into her shoes figuratively and really understand the experience of women in our society. How do you think that's gone in terms of enabling some of that understanding amongst people in our community?
Yeah. At the core, Walk a Mile in Her Shoes started as a fundraiser, right? The YW is a charity, and we need the contributions of donors in order to enable us to do our work every day with women. But the idea behind Walk a Mile in Her Shoes was to get men to sign up, and we now invite women and kids to walk too. But have men sign up to walk in a pair of uncomfortable, super tacky high-heeled shoes, and to get their friends and their neighbors and their colleagues to pledge to support them to do that, and to take that couple of hours in the middle of the day to be part of this symbolic walk, and generate some funding for the YW. But also, you know, it gives us an opportunity really to engage them in a conversation and talk about violence against women and talk about what happens and how many women in this city are living with abuse. And, you know, we know that there's 50 calls a day to the Calgary Police related to domestic conflict. And we also know that most people who are living in abusive relationships never call police.
Right.
So being able to take kind of a lighthearted approach, get people involved in something that we try to make pretty fun, but also have the chance to have that more open conversation. Because I think whether it's Me Too or whether it's violence against women more broadly, for way too long, this stuff has existed in silence and in the shadows. And the fact that we don't talk about it is actually what makes it possible.
So how do you think we get from, you know, bringing it out of the shadow, having the open conversation about it, to the next step about actually not just changing hearts and minds, but, you know, real outcomes in terms of women and vulnerable women and the experiences they have in our society?
Well, I think it's two things. I think, you know, we need to recognize that there are some really systemic barriers. So whether it's around affordable housing or it's around childcare or income, you know, it's some of those basic building blocks that we know are lacking, particularly for super low income folks, primarily women. But it's also about how do we have different conversations with kids when they're young? How do we make sure that sex ed is comprehensive and that it's not just about sexual intercourse, but it's about healthy relationships. It's about how we relate to one another. It's about how we negotiate all sorts of things in relationships that are way more than whether or not someone's going to wear a condom.
Mm-hmm. So you and I met, I think you were first at Calgary Economic Development, but soon after we met, you were at the YWCA, and you were a real big part of executing the move from downtown on the east side with your a large block there to your new facility that's under construction, nearing completion in Inglewood.
Yeah.
So for the YWCA, what do you think that move will help enable for your organization?
So the move is so essential, and it's actually a big part, you know, mission aside, and I get pretty passionate about all things women. My family laughs at me about how I can get riled right up on this stuff. So it was pretty attractive when the opportunity at YW came up. But a big part of what was attractive about the role was also the chance to be part of some pretty important transformation for this 100-plus-year-old charity that had been, you know, kind of stable and always there, but hadn't had big shifts in a lot of years. We've been on the block in the east end of downtown since the early 70s. And, you know, we were sitting on a full city block. The building had really outlived its serviceable life. The boiler in the building is 60 years old. It was donated when it went in. We'd been heavily affected by the flood in 2013 that wiped out our gymnasium. And, you know, the big swimming pool had been empty for a couple of years before that.
I know. I used to play floor hockey at the YWCA gym. It was disappointing not to be able to go there anymore.
Well, I think it was disappointing for lots of folks. And, you know, that gym served some really important purpose with connecting us to a broader group of Calgarians.
Yeah.
And it also, at one point in time, had been a revenue generator for the social purpose of the agency. So it was a loss. But what we also knew is that the organization was sitting on a piece of real estate that was a pretty rare commodity in downtown. So with the combination of us being a different organization, the reality of our balance sheet being what it was, and the land opportunity, we really started to take a big look at what's the kind of facility that we need to support our programming into the future, and how do we want to shift the model. I think there's lots of charities, churches, other organizations who are sitting on land and have a real opportunity to do something different with that so that they can achieve their mission and do that in a more sustainable way. So we're well underway with construction. Our new building will be ready mid-year 2019. And we're in high gear to finish raising the money and get people moved in.
Yeah, so what will being, you know, in terms of the services you provide, the full suite of services from housing to the sort of day-to-day programming, what does the new facility allow you to do? Or, you know, what does the location allow you to do to be embedded in the community? Is it access to transit? What was the impetus for the move to that location?
Well, that location is really close to our YW Sheriff King Home shelter, which has been in Englewood for 30 plus years. So being able to have those two operating locations close together is really important. But it was a huge, huge change for us to be able to be in a neighborhood, right? We work with some pretty vulnerable folks. Mm-hmm. And so being able to be in an area that has been incredibly welcoming to us, right? There's always talk in this city and lots of cities about NIMBYism. We haven't experienced that. We've had, you know, I've had conversations with folks in Englewood who have said, how can I be a better neighbor to the people you serve? And, you know, it kind of makes you want to weep at the idea that I think there's so much inherent good, and being able to be close to transit, close to the new BRT, and close to schools and services is going to be a big shift for the women with whom we work.
Yeah.
It'll also mean that we can really connect our programming in a different way, because we will have lots of services in one building. So someone can come in for a language class and leave their little person in the child minding space. They can be staying in the building. They can come in to use the community kitchen. And in lots of ways, it's going to be way more open and inviting. And you know, to be corny, it's somewhat egalitarian in its intention, because you can have folks there for all kinds of different reasons. And it's not just because someone is low income or because she is leaving an abusive relationship. There's going to be lots of reasons why people are in that building. And for me, that's just a really beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. So just for our listeners, and a whole variety of people, I hope, are listening to the show, but, you know, can you maybe illuminate us a bit, you know, from your perspective, your work with YWCA, what are the big challenges that women and vulnerable women face specifically? Mm-hmm. And maybe a follow-up to that might be, are there things maybe specific to our local context here in Calgary that might provide some particular challenges to women in our city?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, when we're talking about lots of the women who find themselves seeking out the services of the YW or another organization in town, that the drivers behind that are often related to a lack of choice. And that's a lack of choice, whether it's because they are low income, because they are bound to a mortgage or debt or a particular housing situation. Could be because they feel they have no options because they have three kids under six and can't afford childcare and to figure out how to maybe get back into the labor force. There's all sorts of systemic barriers that keep folks from being able to live the lives they want to and have the futures that are kind of bright and that we all aspire to for ourselves and for our kids. I think, you know, when we think about the Calgary context, there's been some really important recognition in the last 18 months and a shift with even Calgary Council endorsing a notice of motion to start to ask questions differently about women, about diverse people and how they're engaging in the city. And I'm really feeling excited and positive about where that's going to take us.
Yeah, so that was, you touched a little bit on, so it was Councillor Carraw that led on the creation of the gender equity notice of motion. So what do you think at the policy level that might mean for women, and how, at minimum within the organization of the City of Calgary, what that might mean in terms of and citizen participation and
you know,
boards and committees and things like that?
Yeah, Councillor Carraw and his team did a really strong job of crafting that notice of motion so that it addressed three specific areas. It was, as you said, about women in elected office and you know, working with Ask Her and Equal Voice and those kinds of organizations to encourage more women to put their names forward. And, you know, we can have a whole other conversation about what the barriers to seeking elected office are and the courage, but also the logistics of that. Mm-hmm. The second part of the notice was about boards and commissions and committees and the recruitment process for that, and how do we make sure that we're not leaving folks out, which the current system absolutely does, because it just fails to ask the questions about who's in.
Yeah.
And then the third piece was around really the equity within how the city delivers services and work on behalf of Calgarians, on behalf of all of us. And so the opportunity is for the city to start to look at gender-based analysis, which is a particular set of analytical tools that just forces us to ask slightly different questions, right? So one of the examples I always use is lots of people want to be involved in maybe an open house about new development that's going to happen in their community. But I've seen way too many of those open houses advertised, and it's going to run from 5 until 7 p.m. on a Tuesday night at the local community hall. Well, I don't know about everyone that's listening, but for me, 5 to 7 on a Tuesday night is when I'm, you know, rushing to get home from the office to, you know, pick up a kid or drive a kid, or, you know, I've missed my bus. I probably need to try and feed them. And when they were smaller, needed to have some time with them, do some reading, do some homework, and try and get people into bed. So going to an open house from 5 till 7 was just an impossibility. And it's not because anyone sets out to say, how can we make this as inconvenient as possible? I actually think that it's just about, how do we open ourselves up just a bit to ask the question, who's not here, mm-hmm. and why aren't they here?
Yeah.
And what would it look like if maybe we had a childcare room right beside this open house? Or what if we did it, you know, in a different way? What if we used technology or online engagement, or, you know, did open houses in a micro way where women are, or where youth are, or where ethnically diverse people are, so that we just start to hear from folks who are otherwise missing the conversations because we've been having the conversations in a certain way for too long.
Yeah, there's a couple really interesting threads I'd like to go down based on what you touched on. I'd love to get back and talk a little bit about women in politics, but sure. You touched on some of the themes of, you know, looking at public decision making through a gender lens. Mm-hmm. And, you know, myself being a developer, you know, we often, when we're trying to create a community, we're trying to understand how the experience of different people will exist, whether it's, you know, people who have mobility impairments, or children, or seniors, or women. Just looking at a problem through a certain lens maybe lead you to make different decisions about certain things. Insofar as we look at this at city building, so I'm thinking, you know, not just the physical environment of the city, but how we deliver programs and services to our citizens. How do we best think about doing that through the lens of, you know, 50% of our population that might have mm-hmm. different perspectives, different needs than men looking at these issues?
Yeah. So I think it, you know, this is going to sound really trite and I don't mean it to, but I think it comes down to just ask them.
Yeah.
And let's be clear, right? When we look at the stats, there are still some super male-dominated industries, and whether that's the development industry, whether it's administration at certain levels in the city, you can't know what you haven't lived. And there's something about then needing to find ways to include the voices of women, the voices of young people, the voices of people with mobility impairments or other disabilities into the conversations, and yeah. and being intentional about doing that, right. Not just saying, hey, everyone was invited, it's not our fault nobody came,
right?
It's about inviting differently and pulling on threads to get to those answers, right? So they, You know, there's all sorts of examples, whether it's about transit or it's about bike lanes. Like, we know that when the decisions are different, when the time for the bus route or the lighting at the C train station or the protected bike lane goes in, that all of a sudden new people show up. Mm-hmm. And that's not an accident, right? So if we actually started to have more intentional conversations to ask people, what stops you from doing this today? We might be surprised by the answer. And I think that actually is not just about benefiting women or other diverse people. It's also about benefiting men, right? And understanding, oh, well, wait, why are you not participating in, a rec class, a dad and kid art program? Maybe the time of day doesn't work for you, right? To be a bit of a word nerd for a minute, it's the distinction between equality and equity.
Okay.
And
talk about that distinction for us.
So for me, equality is about saying everyone had the same opportunity. And, you know, the option is equal, so therefore you either take it or leave it. Whereas equity is about recognizing that we don't all have the same playing field to start with. So whether we're talking about women or people of color or older individuals or gender diverse individuals, we might need to start the conversation differently or acknowledge that even to get folks in the door requires different supports in order for them to be there. Because the playing field, having been designed for far too long by people who, let's be honest, men, white men of a certain age, the playing field looks a certain way. And that's not because people set out to be bad and to be exclusive, although, you know, one could argue that that's what we're seeing play out with Kavanaugh. But I think I think in a broader sense, right, it wasn't intentionally designed to be exclusive, but it also wasn't intentionally designed to be inclusive. So if we really want to get to more equitable places, we need to be more intentional about shifting the barriers to entry.
I've been involved in the last municipal election, I was directly involved in two campaigns, both female candidates. I've seen a little bit up front what the challenges are that women face, you know, totally different expectations, different reactions to their candidacy than men might face. Once they're in office, there's different reactions. I've seen, you know, some pretty ugly things in terms of, you know, the type of vitriol that women in office face compared to men. It is rather different. There are some barriers to entry for women. How do we, you know, we've seen movements like Ask Her. We've seen some uptick in women getting involved at different levels of politics. How do we, and I guess we could tie this into as well, maybe at the more senior levels of organizations and corporate boards and corporate executive leadership.
Right.
How do you see the path forward to breaking through some of those barriers so women are more represented in positions in politics and in nonprofits and in the corporate world?
Yeah. So let's start with why that matters first, right? And I think, you know, whether we're talking about the corporate world or we're talking about the political realm, we know that more diverse decisions most often are actually better decisions. So when corporate boards, when, you know, there have been all kinds of studies that recognize that if you have a more diverse corporate board, the risk tolerance of that corporation shifts, the decision-making shifts, and profitability is positively impacted. So let's start with that as the basis for why do we even care that currently 3 of 15 people on Calgary Council are women.
Right.
So I think recognizing that more equitable representation is important is a good place to start. But I totally agree with you. The vitriol and the BS that women who are courageous enough to put their name on a ballot face is just beyond the pale. And the types of just really crass comments, but also really dangerous and really threatening comments that women I know who have sought office at various levels have faced, it's incredibly disheartening. And I think the ability of folks to understand what that feels like is, again, something that until maybe the Me Too conversation opened up differently, people couldn't appreciate, right? That I think being able to open our eyes and go, wow, that must be really awful to be an elected woman at the grocery store with your child and to be screamed at in the aisle, right? And what does that feel like? And what's the reaction of that woman who's in a place where she's just trying to get through her day and take care of her kid, and now she's being harassed? That to me is a really specific barrier. But there's also barriers around the fact that in lots of cases now, women are maybe the primary income earner in their household. So putting your career on hold to try and seek office is a challenge. That's a challenge for men as well, but I think maybe in a different way. There are the barriers around if you do have children, who's going to look after them? We know women still bear the primary child rearing responsibilities in lots of families.
Yeah.
I think those are all very, very real. And as much as I have tremendous respects for movements that say women just need to be asked, there's definitely that confidence barrier, and mm-hmm. and that is part of what keeps women out. But it's more than asking. It's about making it possible, making it real, supporting folks with understanding what are the resources necessary for a campaign, what's the structure behind that, and then creating the small p political environment that isn't quite so nasty.
Yeah.
That makes it humane enough to participate in.
Yeah, it's been interesting to observe some of the exercise. I think I may have even asked you at one point if you wanted to run for city council, but you said you were more than happy in the job you had. Well, I think was the reaction. But you know, for someone to run for political office, it's not often the first step for them into civic engagement. Do you think we, you know, just need to start with getting women involved at every level of Absolutely. Civic engagement, and then a natural fallout of that will be more women running for political office?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think getting engaged in your community can look like lots of different things.
Right.
And for some women I know, seeking elected office and being that front person is the right choice. But for others, being a great number two is a legitimate choice too, or a great number 37, who's just an awesome, member of their community association board, or volunteer on a campaign, or, a volunteer in a school. Those are all really legitimate contributions too, and let's not minimize them by saying that it's only about the decision makers around the table. That's part of it, but it's not the only part.
Do you think in the big picture, you know, the biggest thing that needs to happen is just, it, you know, both in sort of the corporate environment and executive environment, political environment, is it just getting people generally just more used to seeing women mm-hmm. excel and participate and be leaders in these realms before the change happens?
I think the adage of you cannot be what you cannot see is totally true. We need to have more visible women in leadership in order to make that a possibility. And I'm never one for kind of tone policing, and I think there's too much of that in social movements all the time. But there is also an element of, you know, like, let's just behave ourselves and not be total jerks when somebody is stepping up or stepping out in a way that might be unfamiliar. That doesn't mean that she's uppity. It doesn't mean that she's you know, out of place or needs to go back to the kitchen to sort of pull that 50s trope out. But I think there is still an element of that among some folks, and that's really problematic, because then it starts to affect not only the confidence of those women perhaps, but also the mindset of girls and young women and young men who go, oh, right, maybe she shouldn't be here.
Right. Let's try and finish up on, I hope, an optimistic tone.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, are you, you know, personally, you know, given the work you do and your involvement in the community, how hopeful are you? How optimistic are you about where we might be in five or, say, 10 years from now, both, you know, in Calgary, but also society at large?
I'm hugely hopeful and hugely optimistic. And I think, you know, that's part of how I'm built. I have to live in a place of optimism. I don't think you can work in nonprofit or in community engagement issues and not wake up every day thinking tomorrow could be better than today. Otherwise, the bastards will grind you down. you have to be able to believe that that there's something better out there. So I'm in my 40s. I say this, and I feel like I'm going to be an old lady saying, "I watch the youth of today," and I hear some really fantastic conversations between my own kids, between them and their friends. There were some great videos out this week from young people at Annie Gale Elementary School talking about what they see for the future of Calgary. And I get so jazzed by that, because they do envision a different world than the one that lots of us have grown up in, that has had some pretty narrow lanes that were defined.
You know, one of the big reasons I really wanted you on is you are a leader in our city. You are a mentor to other women in our city here, in our community. You know, if there were some things you could say to, you know, maybe younger generations of women, what would you want to say to them?
It's funny. So I'm thinking of one young woman who worked as part of our team for a while. She was on a practicum with us, and she and I have stayed in touch. And one of the things that I remind her in almost every conversation we have is, you know, righteous indignation is exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't be angry all the time. You need to be able to take a pause and appreciate that we're here for the long game. So, yeah, it's going to piss you off. And there's going to be days when you think, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm standing in the middle of this storm. But let's also pull back to the big picture. Let's remember that, you know, movements like, whether it's the feminist movement or others, they work in waves, and they're incremental. And that can be frustrating for folks who just want it to be different tomorrow. But it's a more sustainable difference if it happens pragmatically and step by step. So I think, you know, yeah, be angry. Yeah, come, you know, wear your pussy hat and come to the march. But let's also know that we need it to be long term.
So I'm just pointing at your t-shirt, which is a picture of a cat, and it says persist. So perhaps you could sum that statement up with it.
I wore this shirt today because I knew we were going to have this conversation, and it's kind of a week that was full of irony, because it's gender equality week, and the Kavanaugh hearings are underway. But I had to wear my persist t-shirt. So it is a little kitty cat, and she's dressed like Rosie the Riveter, so she's pretty iconic. And it just says persist, and I think that is how we need to undertake this, and let's have fun along the way. I had the great privilege of meeting, you know, another icon of the feminist movement a few years ago. Gloria Steinem was brought into Calgary by the YW for an event. And she described that social movements are a century long.
Yeah.
And they move like a corkscrew. So if you sort of envision this corkscrew moving off into the horizon, she said, what we have to appreciate is that movements circle back on themselves. And there might be times when you think, oh my gosh, we're going backwards, but you're still always moving forward. And so that to me is an important metaphor. And the other thing she said that I found so inspiring was, you know, if you want there to be music and dancing and sex at the end of the revolution, you need to have music and dancing and sex throughout the revolution. And I think that's that I take to heart. And I think, you know, we need to celebrate along the way and stay focused on the big picture.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, you and I were joking before we started recording that, you know, our timing for this conversation seemed impeccable, kind of given what's going on. But I think it's always a great time to have these conversations. So, you know, it was an immense pleasure to chat with you in this context. And thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to hopefully contribute to some of the thinking in this speak.
Common Ground YYC is a production of Livewire Calgary. If you value quality local journalism, please consider supporting Livewire by following it on social media, by clicking and reading stories, advertising, or contributing directly via Patreon. Visit livewirecalgary.com.